Number 10A.
We were saying a few hours ago in our class that really we want to see how we can build a bridge from the text of John to the text of the textbook. That these two texts are so different that one can't see, so to say, a similarity between them, that they teach the same thing, because we see the biblical text in its biblical symbolism, and we see the textbook in its scientific symbolism, in very different symbolisms. Also, we must see that the text is showing a linear way of thinking, whereas the message of it is a structural, a whole structure, and therefore demands a structural way of thinking. A structural way of thinking demands that we know the levels of that structure. We know the levels of a hierarchy of the structure. We have seen with this diagram that we have here a hierarchy, that on top of it is the title of the subject, namely that the gospel shows the fourfold calculus of the one being, that is, so to say, the top of the pyramid. And then we go one layer always further down, and like with the pyramid, we see that it gets broader and broader and broader until we come to the ground level. And this is what we have been trying to do and started out. And I have seen already from the top of the subject of the fourfold calculus of being how we can split it up in four sides of the pyramid and see the calculus as a candlestick order, see that science as the word, and that Christ, Christianity, and science, that's a level. We went further to another level, to absolute Christian science, where we had already enlargement of 4 by 2, already 8 points. And sometimes the student asked me a question in this regard, which I think I want to bring up, which is quite a reasonable question. Why then on this diagram we have first on the side, left side, the standpoint of Christian science, and then the standpoint of absolute Christian science, reasoning that absolute Christian science is a higher level than Christian science. So it should really be, they say, absolute Christian science should be on the top and Christian science further down. Now, this is not so. Why? You see, we already have here not just the model of being. In the model of being, you can reason that way because that gives us the groundwork of the categories. But the model of being is just such a deep-seated groundwork that it lends itself for infinite restructuring. Now, here you have you ask first, what is really the main question? And the main question is the fourfold calculus as the candlestick order, and that is on the level of Christian science. So that absolute Christian science is secondary already. The very important level is the fourfold calculus, and absolute Christian science comes in order to explain the impact that absolute Christian science has on that calculus. You see, if we would put absolute Christian science on top of the standpoint of Christian science, then we would not have a line of reasoning. Then all what we would have is truth, love, truth, love, truth, love, truth, love. You see, it wouldn't have really a logical, spiritual, logical theme. The theme is to show the calculus. And so we must see that we only on paper, so to say, on the model of being on paper, we have absolute Christian science on top of Christian science, and divine science on top of absolute Christian science, and science itself on top of divine science. But this is not a good representation. This is just a flat representation. We must see it as a roll, so that you can put Christian science level as a role, so that science itself touches at the end Christian science. You know, if that would be the chart, the model of being, it isn't this way. It is rolling around, rolling around. And therefore, like with a globe, you can never say where the globe begins. You can look at the globe from various sides, and sometimes you see it from the North Pole, sometimes from the South Pole, sometimes from Australia, and sometimes from Europe. And every time you see the same globe differently. So that one cannot say, well, absolute Christian science must in a subject be above. It can be beneath. It can take on a secondary importance. That's what it is, huh? The main importance is the candlestick. Secondary importance is absolute Christian science showing what is at work behind that candlestick. So don't be sidetracked by that. It's a question that has been asked quite often already, even at home already when I made that whole diagram. That they said, well, you should put really absolute Christian science on top of Christian science. And I said, no, because that's not the subject. See, so we must go along the importance of the layers, the importance of the layer. That makes then that pyramid, that makes then really the hierarchical structure. So having done that, I started out with that. Having done that, we could then see that those two layers of the four and the two aspects, that they are intertwining, and therefore we get four times two equal eight main epitomes, the underlined epitomes. And we have seen when we went through those epitomes, text-wise, you didn't feel at all that has anything to do with the text, with the textual text of John. It is all already translated into the language of the textbook, and no more of the gospel. You can read those underlined epitomes as if they would be stated today in a textbook. So we have already bridged really from the side of the biblical text over to the up-to-date symbolism or terminology, and have made it, so to say, a present presentation of the problem of the world of today. Yeah, so that we can't say, well, John was writing 2,000 years ago, and the problem they had at that time were other problems than what we have, and that's true, they had other problems. But they had the same science as we have. So we only have to see that we get away from the symbolism of yesterday and see it in the symbolism of today, but the science of it is the same. Now, let's go to a further, lower level, or level, or what did I say before, layer, in that pyramid, and that is the underlined epitomes, the not underlined epitomes, which means that the underlined epitomes can now be seen in further detail, that having arrived at the underlined epitomes as a statement, we can ask ourselves, what do those statements mean? And we want to have, again, a explanation of a statement. As we have said at the beginning of this class, we must see that we can get true statements, either in the Bible or in the textbook, But that statement per se really don't explain anything. You have to take those statements and find its further implications so that we can explain that statement. Once we have explained that statement, that explanation becomes again a statement which one can further explain, and that gives that pyramid, that structure of the subject. All right, so we start with the non-underlined epitomes, and because the subject is laid out the way as it is, in the first part we have the not underlined epitomes right under the synonymous terms. Can you see you have mind, and then creator is the explanation, the epitome, huh? Do you see where we are? Yeah. Huh? I couldn't put them down because it would not have been so explicable as it is now. What do we do? We have had the epitome, the underlined epitome, which said, truth reveals the Son of God as what? As the divine calculus. So that the Christ idea as a calculus has been come into the focal point. That has been a that is now a statement, which means that it has to be explained. How on earth does truth reveal that Son of God? If I say truth reveals the Son of God, it's a statement. The moment I ask further and say, but how on earth does truth reveal the Son of God? I ask for an explanation. Is that also clear? So that every time we get a more detailed presentation of the subject, so that we are not happy just with statements that have no inner content, but that the statement must be explained through the inner content. So the inner content are now the non-underlined epitomes. We have first, from the standpoint of truth there, we have mind, spirit, and soul, with the epitome just creator, mind, spirit, full reflection, you will know spirit as reflection, and soul as a fourfold calculus. That's how John is explaining here how truth, in which way, in which order, through which ideas, really truth reveals the Son of God. Now, I don't want to go very deep into this explanation, because I just first want to go right through the whole gospel with the non-underlined epitomes, so as to get the rhythm of it, and then I come back again and then show what we can further do when we have that new statement, that we can take those statements into our life and even enlarge them even more, so that it explains to us even in more detail how within us the Christ idea as a divine infinite calculus can be born. So I give first now, as we run through, more or less superficial explanation, which doesn't go right down into the depth. But it still is enough, perhaps, what I will indicate in order to give the spiritual feel of what is happening within our consciousness. Okay, let's take the first underlined and see its explanation through the non-underlined. We have, as I said before, a great statement where we begin, where we see that truth reveals itself. Actually, that truth wants to reveal itself. Always is at the point that it does reveal itself. Revelation is not something that happens every 1,000 years, but it's a nature of truth that it does constantly reveal itself. It's always at the point of expressing itself through revelation. And here it is the question that it should reveal, or it reveals to us what? The Christ idea, the Son of God, as a divine infinite calculus. It's therefore that attitude which John Dolly must have had right at the beginning in the 1910s when he began to see that there is order in the Christian Science textbook, that ideas have order, that being is ordered, and so he must have had that inner sense that there is a truth that wants to reveal more in the textbook than what has been seen up to that point. He must have had that expectancy that there is in the text more than what he knows up to now, or what the movement knew up to now. So it was that expectancy that each one of us really must have, that truth will reveal itself more and more and more and show us more and more about the Christ idea that is ruling the whole cosmos and the whole universe and every individual. And so we come to the non-underlined epitomes, where we begin to see that that revelation comes about through mind, spirit, and soul. That these mind, spirit, and soul are those three great synonymous terms for God, that if we understand them properly and rightly and nurture them, rightly love them, cherish them, adore them, that they begin to operate as a revelation within us. Because John is showing first, right after the prologue, he shows that Logos really does manifest itself, that everything is created by that Logos, and shows that that new light has come, that Christ light has come. How? And he shows us that it didn't come through the blood, nor through the will of the blood, nor through the will of man, but through the light, through God. Gives a first terrific insight. I think this point is a cornerstone, so to say, or even a headstone. If we don't recognize this teaching here at this point, so somehow the whole gospel is in the air. It hasn't a true foundation within ourselves. If we neglect that point of mind, spirit, and soul, we build not on a sure foundation. It's not possible to have a true revelation. Namely, it shows here at the point of mind that actually there is only one creator, and that creator is the Logos, or mind, which means, and that is spelled out properly, which means that we are not created by our parents. The moment we accept that we are the creation of our parents, we start wrongly. We have lost the game. We'll never get anywhere. Because then we accept that the origin is in a parenthood, in a mortal parenthood, and a mortal parenthood never brings forth immortality. Mortality cannot bring forth immortality. So we have to be very careful if we accept in our consciousness that which is our true being, that is not born from parents. Neither through what he says through the blood, that was always a Greek rendering for the woman giving birth, nor from the will, that's usually the manhood side, the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but from God. Well, this is a terrific thing. If we do not start out from that point, and are not accepting right away that the mortal is a mortal from a mortal parents, and that is not the reality of being, that has nothing to do with man at all, that has only to do with the chimpanzees and not with man. So that we must accept, therefore, another creator. We are aware of a creator. We are aware of a creator, but of what creator? And therefore, Mrs. Eddy introduces very nicely and says, there is the divine parent mind capitalized, bringing it right back to God and showing that if we don't accept that actually mind, the divine mind, is the creator, and that we come from that divine mind, from the parent mind, that we have lost the game right through, finished. Things will not work out rightly. We will not be able to see the light at all. Therefore, one should make one a habit. Perhaps you get tired of me when I always repeat this. I've been pounding it down for 40 years, always that terrific sense. Where to start? To start that we are aware every day, whenever we think about it, that we are not created by the human parents, by mortal parents. If we don't accept that we are the creation of the divine mind, you know, superficially everybody says, well, it's a child of God. Well, God has created man, but they don't believe it. It's just rubbish what they say. They don't believe it because they always know that the parents have created them. They always know. And then they put just a sugar layer on it and say, God created man. Yes, he did, but not the way we think about men. And therefore, our very first step is to see that we are not, that our ancestors are not parents, but our ancestry lies in the divine mind. And this is a big thing. If we begin to do that, and happily enough, my mother taught me that when I was quite young, and I did stick to that, year in and year out. Always when I think again about men, I say, now, be careful, be careful. I have had very nice parents, they were lovely parents, I couldn't wish better parents than what I had, that's fine. But they are not my parents. And my mother taught me not to accept that they are my parents. She really drilled it into me in a gentle way to see that man is the idea of God, of the divine mind. And if we see that, then we see that we are welcomed by the divine mind, that we are really wished by the divine mind, that there is no unwished conception, no unwished creation, that I begin to see that therefore the whole creative ability of the infinite mind is that which has brought me forth, and therefore is that which makes up my consciousness, that infinite mind which knows all and which creates all and which is of great ingenuity and of great insight and foresight, that is my origin. From that source I have come forth. And that gives us quite a different starting point. So that we go on to spirit and see that John is telling us that we are born. Now we come to the birth of spirit. That we are born of God. How does it put it? That we are the only begotten Son and is in the bosom of the Father. It's the only begotten Son. It's quite a thing. See, it's not so that each mortal is born by God. There is only one man, the Christ man. There is only one Son of God, Christ truth. So that we must see that we are begotten of the only begotten of God. Therefore, it shows to us that we must not split up the Christ man into lots of little identities called mortal men or human men or men, anyway, using the term man. There is only one man. And so that we see there is only one birth going on and not many births going on, not many Christs going on. There is just one Christ going on that has to be born to us. How is it born to us? Well, it's born to us when we see what he says, that it was always in the bosom of God, that it was always already fulfilled, that it was already at the point of perfection, that it is not something that has to be to start with little and then become bigger and bigger and bigger, but it is always right in its perfection within the what he calls the bosom of God. So that I can see that if I accept any other concept of man but the concept that mind has conceived of man, then I can give birth of the only man there is, the Christ man. And that is my security.